Hello and welcome to this month's episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist, and I'm joined as always by Professor Stephen Fielding. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener.
And Steve is a professor of political history, is that correct?
I do believe I am, yes, remarkably enough.
Quite appropriately for the Zeitgeist Tapes, has written a book on how popular culture covers politics, and that's what we're here to discuss. Every month we take a piece of popular culture and we look at how it covers politics, what it has to say to either our political moment or to the history of politics and the way that it acts. And this month we have chosen to cover, well, technically two different shows, but actually the same show, just with a promotion halfway through, which is Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. And of course, the reason for this, doing this month, is that we've just had the sad death of Derek Folds, who played, Derek,
Bernard Woolley. No, he played Bernard Woolley.
Bernard, that's it. Yeah,
Bernard Woolley.
In both shows.
Yes.
So, Steve, why is this an important show? I know that it's not necessarily your favourite, but I think it has, I mean, deep references. Everybody knows a bit about it.
I would be surprised that even our listener has not heard of Yes Minister. Because when you ever say, oh, you know, you raise the topic of, you know, political comedy, political fiction, somebody always goes, oh, Yes Minister, Yes Minister. And there's a reason for that. Yes Minister, that started in 1980 and it ran to 1988 in its, you know, first iteration, and then was repeated quite a lot after that. During the whole of the 1980s, it was the situation comedy. I mean, it was probably one of the most popular situation comedies, irrespective of the subject. And it proved to be a kind of surprise hit for the BBC, because they first put it on BBC Two, which at that point nobody watched. And then it proved to be so popular, they shifted it to BBC One. And it was regularly watched by, you know, say, 8 million viewers, which, you know, that's quite a big audience. And it spawned books about it. And like I say, it was repeated many times. And it's become, I guess, the iconic political comedy, such that Amano Iannucci, who was responsible for The Thick of It, kind of said, you know, that was his archetype for it. I mean, in many ways, The Thick of It was an updated version of Yes Minister. And it made a really big impact on the audience. What they saw on the screen, they kind of believed. I mean, from various sources and reactions and what reviewers were saying, they thought, you know, this is, by and large, this is kind of how it actually is. And the interesting thing about that is that, I mean, there were basically three characters. There was Jim Hacker, the minister. There was Sir Humphrey Appleby, who was his permanent secretary, who ends up being, when Jim Hacker becomes prime minister, like the head of the civil service. And then there's Derek Fold's character. And by the way, I'm of a generation that always thinks of Derek Folds as Basil Brush's, you know, interlocutor. Well,
that's obviously going to be anyone's greatest gig.
Yes. Well, I think he made it. He kind of nailed that part. I mean, anyone else that came after Derek Folds was a pale imitation. You know,
Derek.
No, but he kind of played the nice guy to Basil Brush. And in the series, he actually played the nice guy. He was the minister's principal private secretary, which meant that he was kind of the middleman between the minister and the civil and the top civil servant, and was trying to make the two things work together. I mean, the basic proposition of Yes Minister was that government isn't run for the benefit of the voter, of the British public. It is basically run for the benefit of the civil servants. And the minister was kind of in there too, but essentially it was run by the civil servants. And it became Margaret Thatcher, or she let it be known, it was like her favourite comedy. And to such an extent that some people said it is actually a Thatcherite comedy. And I will end my little lecture, my TED talk, on this, that's not too surprising, because the two script writers, one of them was Jonathan Lynn, who kind of came out of the kind of Cambridge footlights, bit of a radical, not really left wing, but his attitude was that all politicians are all rubbish.
Mm.
But he was set from a kind of a bit of a lefty perspective. But the other writer was Anthony Jay, who wrote speeches for Margaret Thatcher, who was knighted by Margaret Thatcher, who sat on a committee giving Margaret Thatcher's government advice on family responsibility. And therefore, it's a political comedy, but also it's a very sort of influential, very popular, but also one with a certain message, with a very partisan political message.
I didn't interpret it quite as it's not run for the benefit of the voters, but the benefit of civil servants, so much as it's everybody else just get out of the way. We know what we're doing and we will carry on the ship regardless. And it's in many ways, that's a very pro-establishment message. And on the days when you side with Sir Humphrey Appleby, that's what you're doing, is siding with that kind of old Etonian double first from Oxbridge establishment. But he does get his comeuppance on occasion. Are supposed to find him and his attitudes laughable.
Well, there's laughs, yes. There are laughs in it, definitely. I think it's very stagey. I mean, whether that's because I'm looking now at it and it's quite a number of decades away and it's a particular style of comedy. I mean, it's kind of clever in the wordplay and some of the things and all of that, but it's a bit, it is a bit stagey.
Wordplay is not naturalistic, certainly.
No.
And I think many ways situation comedy has moved away from that kind of unnaturalistic wordplay.
Yeah.
But I don't think it had at the time. I don't think that would have stood out back in the late 70s, early 80s.
No, oh no, absolutely not. No, it was straight down the line in terms of sort of production values. But I don't know. I mean, I think, yes, we are meant to see Sir Humphrey Appleby as he's kind of like the enemy of the people. I'm not sure how much you were meant to sympathise with him.
He's sort of a demi-villain, isn't he? Sometimes you're cheering him on and sometimes you think, oh my God, that's the mask ripped away.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't sustain a series over that number of years by just having someone who's like a one-dimensional black-hearted villain. But broadly speaking, you're right. Sumphrey is representative of the establishment. And that can be read in a number of different ways and was read in a number of different ways because, Thatcher, saw Sir Humphrey and she saw this is the civil service I want to break up. This is the kind of consensual, elitist establishment because she didn't think she was the establishment. Of course, she was breaking that down and creating another one in her own mind. That Sir Humphrey was emblematic, an embodiment of it. And there was even one, just to show how far it went in its critique of the size of government and how government didn't reflect what the voters, the interests of the public. There was one episode where there was a whole controversy about a new hospital that had just been built and it was fully staffed, it had everything. Had everything, that hospital, that new hospital. And so Humphrey was saying, this is a wonder, this is the greatest thing we've ever done, because he was only interested in expanding the power and the influence of the civil service. But the one thing it didn't have was any patience. But so far as Sir Humphrey, you've got a laugh from it because it's quite funny. But Sir Humphrey, for Sir Humphrey, that wasn't the problem. There was no problem. Because the size of the civil service got bigger because of it. So that, in the way that I saw it, that kind of brings out what he was essentially saying, that government's too big, it's only run for the civil servants. And in the end, Anthony Jay, when it was all over, he fessed up and said, that's kind of, there was a political message. This is what we were saying. But the audience lapped it up. I mean, there were people who criticised it at the time, but they were very much the minority.
Oh, and I mean, I watched it every week with my deeply socialist, un-Thatcherite parents.
Mm.
And we all adored it. I think I had a bit of a crush on Derek Fowles, in fact.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I was eight.
Blimey, that was precocious.
I think I just thought he was sweet and nice.
Oh, he is. Oh, in the series, he is.
Lovely. And I think he plays that foil role. You've got the two... the two sparring titans, one at the top of politics, one at the top of the civil service.
Mm.
And they both need that foil in the sweet and innocent. And he maintains his innocence whilst trying desperately to understand the gameplay going on around him.
Yes. I mean, in very...
I suppose he's the audience in many ways.
No, I think you're absolutely right. He kind of presents the minister's case to Sir Humphrey and then Sir Humphrey's case to the minister. And he's there to highlight the idiocies or the weaknesses of the case on either side. Yeah. And so that's essentially his character. It's amazing that someone can remain so naive and yet reach the highest level of the civil service. But, you know, you kind of forget about that, I guess.
Perhaps it's tactical naivety.
Yes. Yes. So, that's kind of spoilt it for me, really, because I mean, obviously I watched it. I was a bit older than eight. I watched it on and off. And at the time, I thought that was fine. But it was only after I started looking into it for my book a little bit more. And then you see all the little asides as well in the series about that, which are totally unnecessary. There's a consistent hostility to comprehensive education. I mean, it's a given. It's just a given that comprehensive education is rubbish, right? There's another one about local government, that local government is, and the 1980s being the time of, you know, the so-called loony left and things like that, that local government is seen as a byword for lunatic left-wingers who pop up occasionally. And there is also a really nasty, very, you know, it raises itself rarely, but it's there, about, you know, I mean, obviously Thatcher and Clause 28 was happening, and it took the side of Thatcher and Clause 28, you know, quite obviously. So
that's interesting, because they also did do a bit of kind of puncturing the civil service's non-approach to political correctness, because there's a wonderful bit that I remember about they decide that they need more women.
Oh, yes.
And then they go around the cabinet table and each cabinet member says, this is absolutely right, just not in my department because X, Y, Z excuse. I think Sir Humphrey calls himself an ardent feminist. And then they decide that it's fine because 99% of the typing pool are women.
Yes, yeah. But I think that might be the same episode that I'm thinking of, when they actually do find a woman who isn't a tea lady and isn't a secretary, who's actually a kind of a mid-ranking civil servant. And the minister, of course, the minister's objects here are mixed, and he wants to look good as well as do good. And he wants to basically positively discriminate in favour of her, and they faff around about it, and you know she clearly deserves to be promoted, and again this gives away what the essential kind of thrust of the series really was about. In the end, she gets fed up with all of this. I mean, they offer her the promotion, but she then says, you know, you've kind of faffed me about quite a lot on this. I've got a job in the city. Because the city is the place where women are treated equally compared to men, which of course is ridiculous.
I mean, really laughable. Yeah,
of course it's laughable. But the idea. So you got the series saying, well, the city of London is this acme of equal opportunities compared to, you know, Whitehall. I'm sure Whitehall was terrible in the 1980s, but you know. Anyway, so
too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of the attitudes are of its day, but they're of its day politically. I mean, it is very biased. It's very biased. But the interesting thing about it is also that actually, I mean, there were things in it that were, and this is at the time, people who watched it and commented on it said, you know, there's a lot of accuracy here, and there was a lot of accuracy here because they based a lot of their plots and storylines on the experience of the last Labour government, which also was having problems with the civil service in different ways, and so you could, there was a sense in which you could be a bit on the left. I mean, Tony Benn, of course, you know, he had lots of run-ins with civil servants as a kind of a bulwark against what he wanted to do as a minister, radical minister. So there were elements where it was describing a situation where the civil service were an important player. in government, whether you were on the left or on the right. But because of the context, when it came out, and because Thatcher appropriated it, and because one half of the team were already on board with what Thatcher thought about the about government, it really kind of had a right-wing iteration, in the same way that the thick of it probably had, well, definitely had a kind of left-wing kind of emphasis, didn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure left-wing so economically, but sort of liberal. No.
Yeah, liberal left. Yeah, liberal left, yeah.
Now, going back to something you said earlier and bringing that back to this kind of right-wing approach, there is definitely a sense, you know, and an argument made, and maybe we can listen to this clip now, yeah, about power, where it should lie. And it goes back to what you were saying about, you know, the real clashes that were happening at the time between local government and central government.
Sure.
Something that we find hard to imagine now because local government, you know, has been quite stripped of that power. Despite the fact that it absolutely shouldn't be. So should we have a quick listen?
Yeah, so this is going to be Derek Folds as Bernard Woolley coming in and talking to Sir Humphrey, isn't it, about local government reform?
Yeah, absolutely. Which he starts off in favour of, foolishly.
Bernard, I want to have a word with you about Professor Marriott's article.
Yes, I think it's about time we reform local government.
Do you, Bernard?
Yes. At least I think I did. That is, I'm not wholly against it. Although there are many convincing, some might say conclusive arguments against it.
Some might indeed, Bernard.
Yes. Why?
Because, Bernard, once you create genuinely democratic local communities, it won't stop there.
Won't it?
And of course it won't. You see, once they get established, they'll insist on more power. And the politicians will be too frightened to withhold them, so you'll get regional government.
Would that matter?
Bernard's going to sit down. Bernard, what happens at the moment if there is some vacant land in, say, Nottingham, and there are rival proposals for its use, you know, a hospital, a college, or an airport?
Well, we set up an interdepartmental committee, Department of Health, Department of Education, Department of Transport, Treasury, Environment, ask for papers, hold meetings, propose, discuss, revise, report back, redraft, a normal thing.
Precisely. Months of fruitful work. Leading to a mature and responsible conclusion. But if you have regional government, they decide it all in Nottingham. Probably in a couple of meetings, complete amateurs.
It is their city.
And what happens to us?
Well, much less work.
Yes, much less work. So little that ministers might almost be able to do it on their own. So we'd have much less power.
Well, I don't know whether I really want power.
Bernard, if the right people don't have power, do you know what happens? The wrong people get it. Politicians, councillors, ordinary voters.
But aren't they supposed to in a democracy?
This is a British democracy.
How do you mean?
British democracy recognises that you need a system to protect the important things of life and keep them out of the hands of the barbarians. Things like the opera. Radio 3. The countryside. The law, the universities, both of them. And we are that system. Gosh.
Yeah, good old Derek, always trying to be the good guy, but always folding in the end.
Yeah.
So that kind of, again, and I guess you don't have to be on the left or the right to sort of listen to that and go, yeah, the central, you know, government in Britain is far too centralised. And ironically, it's now more centralised, at least in England, isn't it? Than it, you know, yeah, because local government.
It's worse actually in Scotland and Wales because of the decentralisation of parliaments.
Right.
Actually, local government had a lot of their powers taken up into the Scottish Parliament.
Yeah. Right.
Assembly, so actually they have even less power at local level there.
But in a way, like I was saying before, and in the series itself was promoting a very negative view of counsellors. So, you know, it was, you know, like all comedies, often they have their cake and eat it. So it's putting the case for democracy and then juxtaposing the civil servant as being unreasonable because they don't want to let go of any power. And yet then another instance giving the lie to that being what the series really wants, because well, you don't really can't really trust councillors anyway, because they're all left wing, they're all nutters, they're only like little versions of national politicians. So it's, I mean, that's the thing about the series as a whole. It's so horribly cynical.
I was just going to say that it cynicism runs through it like a stick of rock, but it's in very British attitude toward politics. I don't think Yesminster is responsible for that. I think it reflects that attitude is absolutely prevalent.
No, I wouldn't say that it was responsible. I mean, it was obviously tapping into, you know, but the 1970s was a time when lots of people were losing faith in government, in any kind of public authority. I mean, that's one reason why some people turned to Thatcher, because she was promising to let people free of government restriction and, you know, to be decisive rather than anything else. And this is one of the things about doing a podcast live, listener, is you sometimes get a phone call.
And
yes, well, yours was before we started recording.
Yeah.
So I can't just talk to my mum. I'll just anyway, crashing on. Yes, it didn't invent cynicism about politics, but it definitely mined it. And there's a very interesting kind of poll, or there's some kind of poll evidence which I've I talked to the head of Maury once via Twitter and whatever, that Maury, Ipsos Maury, have taken a poll or a survey of public attitudes about different professional groups and the extent to which the public trust those professional groups to tell the truth. And they've taken it since about 1983, and there are little gaps, and now it's kind of an annual thing. And in some of those groups, there's a completely almost a consistent line. You know, like politicians, it's about 15 to 20%. You know, through this whole since 1983, that only 15 to 20% or so of the public trust politicians to tell the truth. Right? Civil servants at the start of this survey, which is 1983, which is at the height of Yes Minister, civil servants are really, you know, in terms of public trust in them to tell the truth, very low. Right. And they are one of the very small number of groups who rise in public estimation to tell the truth. And the rise is after Yes Prime Minister stops being broadcast. Right?
That's a wonderful stat.
I mean, it is a significant, I mean, there's one of the group, and it's trade union leaders, who at the start of that period are very low, and then, you know, during the course of the period, increase in public trust. And that, and I read that as because they've got no power anymore. You know, nobody even knows, you know, so far as they're compared to the 80s. But civil servants, I cannot think of any other reason why public trust should increase in civil servants apart from the fact they aren't seeing Sir Humphrey Appleby saying terrible things every week about, we want more power, we're only here to serve ourselves, you know, not the public. So it might have had some effect. It might have, at least in that period, to reinforce that kind of Thatcherite agenda of, you know, we have to break up the state. We've got to put all these things out to agencies, not embedded civil servants, you know, all that kind of stuff. It might have had some kind of an effect.
I mean, what's extraordinary is there's only 23 episodes, I believe, altogether. And it was last made in 1988. And yet, yeah. Sir Humphrey is still absolutely the byword for the civil service.
It is for journalists. Yeah, journalists would use it. And as a consequence, you know, because they'll be mostly of a certain generation. Of course, they'll be interested in politics more than most people. I mean, it would be interesting to know, you know, how much of a figure he is more widely. But yeah, he is an iconic figure for people who think about these things. He is representative. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it had a very big impact on how people thought about the civil servants for a time. And it has left a very big kind of legacy. And like I say, Amano Iannucci was kind of consciously updating Yes Minister with the thick of it.
Yeah.
And he's a big fan of Yes Minister. I mean, he's one of those that says it's basically telling you the truth about power. And the thick of it is really just, I mean, the civil servants in the thick of it aren't really at all important anymore, which again kind of reflects at least people see politics. And it's the spin doctors, isn't it?
I mean, if you look at some of the objections to Blair's civil service reform, and there was quite a lot of civil service reform under New Labour, some of that was that the power went away from the apolitical mandarins to the political actors like Alistair Campbell, etc.
Although, you know, arguably, I mean, and one of the arguabilities would be, if you go and look at Yes Minister, the civil servants have a political, you know, that if politics is about power, those civil servants had power, you know, they are political. And I mean,
yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And I think the professionalisation of the civil service is a good thing. I was, you know, it's something I was in favour of, but I do. But that is the counter narrative that Armando Nucci was largely selling.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, politics, the form of politics had somewhat changed. Civil servants weren't the most powerful figures anymore. But yeah, it's, I mean, I can't watch it anymore, Yes Minister, without feeling depressed and annoyed. I can. And
what you're saying is never write a book.
Yeah. I mean, I really ended up loathing it. I mean, partly but it was also partly because everybody said, "Oh, you're writing this book about political fiction." Oh, Yes Minister, that's really great. No, it's not really.
Does everyone talk to you about the Westminster? Yes Minister and the West Wing. Is that all you ever get?
Well, it used to be. It used to be. Yeah. But actually, funnily enough, and this is neither here nor there really, but I started off hating the West Wing and then ended up really liking the West Wing. So I don't know what's going on there. But Yes Minister, it's very well produced. It's some of the performances are very well crafted. Some of the interchanges, while the politics is a little bit hokey, a bit dodgy, is very well done. Very well done. And it does. So, you know, it kind of was part of how people thought about the civil servants at that time and helped really shape how some people thought about them. But I do find it a loathsome creation.
Well, there you go. So I've always been terribly, terribly fond of it, but mostly in memory than in sort of, you know, I haven't watched an awful lot of it in modern times.
No.
So maybe I'm just remembering little 8-year-old me sat with my mum and dad watching it before I went to bed.
Well, it could be nostalgia. In the same way that I'm maybe nostalgic for the Derek Folds of Basil Brush time, you're nostalgic for the Derek Folds of Yes Minister. And obviously there'll be generations who come after us who possibly nostalgic for the Derek Folds of Heartbeat. And maybe we should just end by just noting that Derek Folds' performances in all three, in very different circumstances, playing very different characters, well, they've left an imprint on us all.
Absolutely. And God rest you in peace, Sir Derek Folds. And I think on that note, we should probably leave it there. Just say thank you as always, Steve.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you to
Stuart Wood of Anfield, Lord Wood of Anfield, for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.